Hey Josh, how you doing, buddy?
Awesome, Nikos. Great to hear your voice. How are you?
Yeah, okay. I'm loving the sunshine in Austria. Going out mountain biking most days, sitting at the lakes, studying and reading at the lakes. It's nice to get into nature.
That's the truth, Matt. It's great just to see the stars where I live, because I'm in the city, man. So it's light pollution prevents even us from seeing stars. So it's my heart is with you in Austria.
I'm 100 meters from a country trail, and then I'm also 1 kilometer from a little lake that's sort of really hard to get to, inside of this other sort of rivers, and it's sort of like a sun trap. It's just so nice for just sitting there and meditating.
Wow, man. Well, I'm 100 meters from where someone was shot in the arm and in the hip last night while I was laying in bed. That arrested me from sleep and threw my body to the ground. So it sounds like we've got a little bit of a different situation going on.
This is where I stayed in Minneapolis.
Yeah. This is the home you stayed in. Literally, I can literally look out the window I'm sitting in front of right now and see it was all police taped last night. Literally, the tree next to my house was going across the street to block off probably 20 to 30 rounds fired. And I think 2 people were hit, but I haven't confirmed that. But I know 1 person was hit, according to the Facebook page. But I mean, gun violence is an all-time high, it seems like. And yet, I'm sure that's not true. I'm sure history tells a different story about violence, but you feel it more than ever. So I would love to be by that nice little trail you're mentioning earlier. Oh man.
So Josh has been on the show a couple of times before. Recently we talked to him just after George Floyd was killed, and he talked about his life, how he chooses to live in his neighborhood. He likes to live amongst people from different nationalities. How's that going?
Yeah, man, that's the great privilege of this life. And I think it really does tie this heart intention, this motive I have, my family and I have, to be around people who are different from us. Really, I think it's right down into what we're talking about here with Derek Chauvin and George Floyd and all that sort of has erupted on the planet, you know, surrounding, you know, the abuse of authority and racial injustice. So I love my neighbors, and it seems my neighbors love me. We're learning about each other. It's pretty exciting. I even had so your audience might not know, 2 things that are important to me. 1 is that I'm a passionate follower of Jesus. And 2, I run a short-term rental business, which is how I met you, right? So you came and stayed in one of my listings. And I was just talking to a guest who's been with me, I think maybe the last 2 months, just this morning. His room was right out where the shooting happened. And when I went up to the window after the gunfire stopped, I looked over at this other property where he's staying, and I could see he was in his window looking down. And he says to me this morning, I'm talking to my Somali Muslim neighbor who is just amazing. And I'm telling him just what's going on. And he heard the gunfire, but didn't look out much at all. And so this guest of mine comes out and he says, man, what is this, man? I just love this neighborhood. I love the neighbors here, but what is it with this violence? I know these people are not, I've been here long enough. I know these people are not from your neighborhood. It's such a weird thing, you know? So yeah, I'm finding myself living around folks who are wildly different from me culturally, religiously. And yet then there's this other element of people who are making bad choices, and it's really carrying them to dark places. So that's my last 12 hours, roughly.
It seems to be a number of shootings since we last talked, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, gun violence is is pretty intense. I did have some stats, but I don't have them in front of me here. The percentage of gunfire, we have these things in Minneapolis, is way up. It's I want to say like 1,000%, but I don't hold me to that. I bet you could Google it. Minneapolis, they have these devices called shot spotters. It's a device essentially that is sound and camera together. And when it detects gunfire, because gunfire is a pretty distinct sound, it senses where the sound came from and then spins a camera around and looks right on where the sound came from. And these are scattered all throughout our city. And I know in the south end of Minneapolis, which is where George Floyd died, it's where I live, about 20 blocks from where George Floyd died, it's up like 1,000%, or it's some crazy percentage. I mean, if it's up 100%, you'd be like, what? It's up 100%? And it's like way north of there. So yeah, lots of people being shot. I just was with another guy, as a friend of mine, 2-3 days ago. He's sort of in recovery right now. He's in early stages of getting sober. And he said, yeah, my friend just got shot and died. And then he goes on talking about it. And it was literally someone who was just in the news that died maybe 4 or 5 blocks from my house, drug related. And this is the scene that this friend of mine is really struggling, drugs and alcohol, struggling to get out of. And he's on his way. I know he's on his way. But to hear his friend dying because of gun violence and drug related, it's heartbreaking, really.
So you're saying that gun violence has gone up 100% since George Floyd's death?
It's the shot spotter. Let me just see if I can Google it. I don't want to take us off track too much here, but here, if I can find it fast. Sorry, just give me a second here. Yeah, I'm not seeing it here, and I want to get an actual stat that at least is out there, but I know it's way up and I'm not seeing it right now. I wish I could. Maybe you can include it in your notes. I'll find it for you and you can put it in the notes.
Yeah, no worries.
What the percentage up is, but it's pretty crazy. So, but I know, we've got a lot of things we can talk about here. So, I'd be happy. What's your thinking, Nikos?
Yes. What was the atmosphere like at the George Floyd's trial in your neighborhood and greater neighborhood if you were around it?
Yeah. It's interesting because there is such a heaviness that's over, I think, a lot of our society right now, which is, partly because of this coronavirus and the financial impact I think it's having on people, pros and cons. But for a lot of vulnerable minorities, it's really a negative. And then put on top of that, this unrest that happened with George Floyd's death and all things related to that. And there's definitely a spirit of heaviness that has pervaded, I would say. And those of you that don't know me, I'm a white male, grew up in America, mid-America. So, I mean, it's sort of need to get me into your box, at least on some level from that vantage point. I am among the privileged. And, I recognize that. I know there's a lot of things I don't understand. But I do sense, as a white male who is a minority in my neighborhood, by far pretty much a minority, there's a heaviness. There's a heaviness among people. And I think especially among the African-American community. Several African-American neighbors, and while African-Americans are not a high percentage in our neighborhood, those that I've talked to are, there's a heaviness. I can tell you about a particular friend I have that, so with some of the things he said, I was with him the night of the announcement of the verdict. And there's just a real heaviness over him, and he's been a victim of gun violence himself. So, you just hear this sort of relief, but yet it's not really remedying the problem. And So there's this weird relief, but then also this, there's really no solution on that front. So, yeah.
Can you describe more what the relief looks like?
You know, I'm looking onto it. I don't think I can, you know, and I know that that's maybe not what you'd like to hear from a guest on your podcast, but when I look on to people who are systemically pushed aside or in minority positions of influence of power as a person who is a white American from middle America, I try to look on with real, genuine interest to understand and to come humbly. And, you know, like, for example, the concept of justice, all around our city, you would see signs that says justice for George. And as a person who follows Christ, follows Jesus, the Messiah, I think about justice and the supreme justice held in the event of Jesus dying for us somehow. And you look on and you say, at least from the perspective of those who follow Christ, that is a very peculiar event. Look on to what is justice to the average person who's got that sign up in their business or spray painted on the walls, or you just ask people about it. What I find is that people really don't have a lot to say about what justice for George is. And that to me is odd and shocking, you know, to think about what is justice for him. Is Derek Chauvin being killed by the state? Would that make you believe that there is justice for George Floyd? Would that make justice? You know, it's, and of course we don't have that. We don't have the death penalty in our state. And so would him be put away for the rest of his life? He never sees the light of day virtually. Would that make justice for George? You think about the value of a human life and its relationship to justice. And it seems like there's something missing to the conversation about justice. And I don't have the answers, but I certainly want to be a part of the conversation and thinking more carefully about what justice is, how we're going to get it. So
has Derek been sentenced yet?
He hasn't been sentenced. It's going to happen next month, I believe, towards the end of June.
Okay.
The state is seeking higher sentencing for the crime because I think there are speculation why, but there was that 9-year-old girl who had a T-shirt on that said "Love," watching George Floyd die. So I think with a minor being present for the act, I think that's at least one source of the state's defense to seek for a, sort of an aggravated sentencing, which he did agree to have the it not done by a jury, but done by the by Cahill, by the judge. So yeah, I think looking on to what justice is and really taking a close examination has a lot of opportunity for us to think more carefully, both about the uniqueness of the system that we live in, the good side of the system, trial by jury of peers, being tried largely in the place where the event happened, those people having to decide altogether what they want to do with the charge, how that process is unfolds. And I think a lot of Americans have never been exposed to the finer workings of our legal system and really how if there, whatever there is of justice, the good sense of justice that can come out of someone being held accountable for crime, has a crime been committed? Is that person guilty of that crime? You begin to look on to what justice is from that vantage point. And I for sure, I just have to step back again and say, is that really justice? But then kind of moving into it, you start to think about, wow, a jury deciding an individual's fate on specific crimes that the burden of proof are on the prosecution, and the judge has to decide how much evidence is brought in, admissible, not brought in. He instructs the jury to try to forget or not consider information that was presented during the case. It's amazing. In the closing arguments, you have, these are just examples here, you have the judge deciding to reread a little bit of his instructions that he had given before because of something that the defense attorney said that was not, according to most, not correct as the law reads. And you see the judge not choosing to read it. I mean, there's just so much complexity to some kind of justice. And I think we look on to it pretty casually and don't realize how complex it is and don't have a right kind of frame of heart and mind relating to the justice system, what justice is.
Yeah, I don't think the story's finished yet, because I've heard some pretty convincing arguments on both sides, and there's potential for an appeal here. So that could really stir up things a whole lot more later on this year, if there is an appeal. I don't know if there is or not. I have to wait and see.
I think there will be an appeal, the way it sounds. I mean, the way I've understood it so far, and I could be wrong on all of the stuff I'm saying, so please feel free to fact check me and prove me wrong if I am wrong. I'm happy to be wrong. I would like rather to be right. I think appeals are pretty common. The way I understand it is 90% of them are not, they don't move forward. So even if the appeal is all but guaranteed, still 90% of them don't move forward. So it's a 10% that it does actually is effectively appealed. And then what does that move towards? It could move towards a mistrial. It could move towards, it moved in a lot of directions. So is the appeal, and you've got three events that I've at least highlighted that happened during the trial that make an appeal more plausible. The three things are the fact that the city had this momentous settlement for the civil side of the event of George Floyd's death during jury selection. You had two jurors who dropped out because they felt they couldn't be fair and impartial. And then a little later then, so then they get their jury and they start the trial. And then you have Dante Wright's death, which happened in Brooklyn Center, which if you don't know Minneapolis, it's like an inner ring suburb. It's just right next to Minneapolis. And so you have his death, which is clearly an accident by the officer, an accident that cost Dante Wright's life, nonetheless an accident. And so, again, I'm not one way or the other on it, I don't think, but we all have a bias for sure. But you have that happening, and then buildings being burned down. And I know one of the alternates, because you know they have 12 jurors plus the two alternates, one of the alternates lived in Brooklyn Center, right? Literally, like she sees smoke coming up the burning buildings while she's in the final stage of the trial. And then you have third, on the day of closing arguments, you have, I don't know this politician, but from what I understand is she's pretty far left. She's basically saying, if there's not a conviction, there's going to be consequences. So you have, you know, someone from a branch of government sort of asserting their voice during the process of this trial and then the final closing stages. And these are three really big things that are extraordinary in an extraordinary trial. So I'm not sure what basis those have, but I think those are three major things that an appeal could help to find successful. But, you know, on the other side, I think it's going to be pretty difficult from what I'm understanding, you know, to improve upon the situation of selecting a jury, fair and impartial, as it was, you know, if they were to not be, if they were sequestered for the whole trial, that would maybe be a significant difference. Some people think that if they were to move the trial to another location, that that might help things. But, you know, I'm not convinced by that. I don't think that's going to change things much, but I could be wrong. So yeah, it will be interesting to see if the appeal does go forward.
Yeah, and we'll be covering it later on when it happens. So you were also telling me that you met a journalist that actually knew the young man that was killed, Dwayne, I think.
Yeah, so yeah, that's close. So in my short-term rental business, I had a guest who has traveled the country sort of photographing, capturing some of these events. And I know he mentioned mostly the Breonna Taylor event, her death. But he's been a part of several, and he's here for photographing the trial. And then of course, Dante Wright dies. And so he was involved in taking pictures of that. And the day that I met him in person, this is just what kills me. Really nice guy. Really nice guy. I mean, we had a great conversation, I think, in the end. But, you know, being a person who is really trying my best to be allegiant to God and allegiant to his Messiah, Jesus, I'm just a little bit leery about power over. And you see such a misuse of power just in general, which is, again, as I said up front, one of the two big things here in this situation we're discussing. And so I'm not the biggest voter. I just find, if we could just get ourselves allegiant to God, we'd be in much better shape. But nonetheless, he's a part of the media, and you know, he's rightfully sharing the grief that he had been with family members of Dante Wright, and that day, and literally his son taking pictures, his son playing with his camera, is obviously just very tender and intimate kinds of interactions with his families. And you could just see his heart. He's a white guy. His heart for these people was just oozing out of him. Like, he's just so desperately wants to be a part of one side of the story and the change that's desperately needed for the people he's photographing. And yet, in the midst of me talking with him, he didn't know that Dante Wright had a warrant for his arrest for possessing a firearm and fleeing from law enforcement. And I just
take a mission faction.
Yeah, I mean, and that is, you know, I was with a friend of mine who's a history buff this morning, and he said, you know, we self-select. We just are so good at it. He used better words than self-select, but that's the sense I caught. There's something about, we just want the information we want, and we don't want the information we don't want. And that problem is, obviously, it's an age-old problem. And yet here, he didn't know this basic information. And I mean, it goes further than that. Apparently, Dante Wright had held someone at gunpoint who he had stayed over Zat's house when they came back with rent money, and basically insisted on taking the rent money at gunpoint. Now, that's what I found online about that situation. And so that was on a mainstream news site. So you just think to yourself, okay, the story isn't as simple as people want to make it. You know, when I first heard of Dante Wright's death, I heard he was pulled over for having a air freshener hanging from his rear view. It's all, and now he's dead by at the hands of a police officer. That's the story I heard. And it's like, okay, well, if you just accept that news clip, well, of course, that's terrible. And let me tell you, again, God is very interested in human life. It's his greatest fascination, human life, the value of human life. And no one can bring back a person who died, especially when it's done unjustly. So if God's interested in that, anybody who wants to follow God is going to be interested in that. And yet, as we think about his death and we see this story of events that led to it, from the news side, it's just like, you should at least know the other side. You should really know that. And then I turned to him and I just said, what troubles me is because people are so caught up by headlines today, they just love a headline, is that what would happen in the news? Because I deeply believe in the value of the news and free press. I'm totally in on that. I think that's so important to a healthy society. It seems to me like, what if the news people actually tried their best to present all the facts instead of a headline that grabs attention to drive revenue for advertisements? Well, that would be a totally different scenario. And yet, you can see that this guy is passionate about what he's doing with his photography, and he's compassionate towards people who have been affected and are grieving by the loss of loved ones and at the hands of law enforcement. And yet, and not know that basic fact tells me something. And it's not like it's a brand new event, and you know, just it, like the story's unfolding. I mean, this is. That had been out in the news for a while by the time this conversation happened. So it's like, you're not looking for it. And that just, it hurts my heart, really, truly.
I wonder if it's a fear of not following the narrative. Maybe that's why they're choosing to know these facts.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said about that. You know, I don't know if I'm going too far to say it this way, Nikos, but, you know, we all carry around hurt. If you've been alive in this fallen world, you carry around hurt. A lot of people have ways they try to fix that hurt. And, you know, when you carry around hurt, you're likely to respond to circumstances, to stimuli by hurting other people. So you've maybe heard the phrase, hurt people hurt people. I think that to me is the source problem we're facing. You have a wound, you carry it around. It clouds your ability to be able to be a more objective. I don't think anybody is ultimately objective. I think everybody's subjective. But to be more objective, that's hard. That's a difficult thing to do. So, of course, we just want to hear what we want to hear in the news, and we listen to those people. And I mean, for me today, I don't like the news, but I also know I'm a global citizen. I want to know what's going on, at least have some version of what people are saying. So you can't even listen to the news in the United States alone anymore. You have to go outside of the United States and listen in various ways, various different people to try to get a sense of if there is some sort of common thread to like gravitate towards that. But pretty hard with the news, I think, this way.
Also worried, I think, that there's a lot of malefactors taking advantage of this division and promoting division and anger, and people are seeing each other as their enemies when they should be looking at the puppeteers that are trying to control the situation for their own benefit and exacerbating the differences. And that's what really makes me angry. I think we see playing out in America.
It's very true. I think there's, and again, you know, in my worldview, and unfortunately I don't hear enough of this in my opinion either, we're not enemies of one another. The enemy, a according at least to the paradigm of those who follow Jesus, is Satan. And yet Satan has humans hating each other and fighting each other. And this to me is what makes the claim of Jesus, following Jesus, so unique. Jesus tells us to turn the other cheek, not to retaliate, in Sermon on the Mount. He says that we're supposed to love our enemies and pray for them. You know, it's like, what if, how are we going to do that in this world? Well, I mean, Jesus, I think, is giving power for that. And unfortunately, we don't have that narrative of truth prevailing today. We have people grabbing on to a lot of other things that are not love your neighbor as yourself. And regardless, even if you don't follow Christ, which I'm sure a lot of your podcasters might not follow Christ, you know, love your neighbor. I mean, come on. I mean, most faiths in the world have love your neighbor as a central tenet, and it's the central identifying tenet of a follower of Christ, to love your neighbor. There's nothing, no system I've ever discovered, and I've been a person of faith studying other faiths for my entire adult life, there's no system that comes close to the claim, love your neighbor, like those who follow Jesus. And yet, people don't have that, and so it's like hatred to harbor in our hearts. It's so easy, and no one wants to talk about that. I mean, this is what kills me, man. Can I go on a little bit about hatred for just a second here?
Yeah, sure, man. This is great.
So in the same sermon, Sermon on the Mount, it's often called Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 5, 6, and 7. In chapter 5, right, Jesus says, you've said long ago, you shall not murder. Anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you, anyone who's angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Anyone who says to a brother or sister, Raka, which is fool, he'll be answered to the court. Anyone says you fool will be in danger of the fire of hell. So let's set aside the second part. Murder is equated with anger.
Yeah.
Jesus actually challenges us to reframe the power of anger and really the ultimate misuse of anger. And he contrasts it or compares it with murder. Now, you know, with murder, we all look at it. We say, wow, how is it that he could have kept his knee, Chauvin could have kept his knee on George Floyd's neck for that length of time? Well, I'll tell you, it has something to do with anger. Listen to this verse. 1 John 3:15, everyone who hates his brother is a murderer. And you know that eternal life does not reside in a murderer. Everyone who hates his brother is a murderer. Now, it seems really weird to me because we certainly look on the news and we see murder and we think to ourselves, oh, but do we do that with hate? I'm just telling you, as much as our civilization is advancing, epic proportion, change, advancement, as society, we literally don't know how to deal with hate. And we harbor it in our hearts. And I think it's really at the center of this conversation. And if it's not at the center of the conversation, I think you're missing the point. The problem is hatred. And hatred is leading people to do things. People hate themselves, people hate others, and this is leading to murder. Hatred is the problem. People don't want to deal with that. They don't know how to. They need some sort of help. I think that's where anyone who is a person of faith, any major religion today, at least, is going to have some sort of help from that. And I personally think there's no one like Jesus who can offer help with that. If you're willing to examine the facts, if you're willing to examine, you will find that he is utterly unique on this front, unlike anyone ever to have lived. But So hatred, it's a real problem in leading people to do terrible things. God help us.
Yeah, you gotta, it's quite likely that Derek had hatred in his heart when he had his knee over George Floyd's neck, and probably he didn't intend to kill him. But it's likely that the hatred stopped him not having him on that position and maybe offering CPR sooner. And I mean, you can almost guarantee that if he knew that George Floyd would have died, he wouldn't have done that, because he's now going to resurrect his life, you know. But you can certainly see that there's likely an animosity there. And now he's paying the consequences of that.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, it's hard to know if Chauvin had hatred in his heart, but it's. I just heard after the verdict that there was a similar situation where Chauvin was called to a house and had his knee on a young black man's neck, and the mother, who I think called the police herself on her son, then asked Chauvin to get off of her son, and Chauvin did. You just think about this, and in multiple minutes of holding his knee on his neck. So it wasn't like a short time. It was like an extended time. And this just happened, I'm not sure what the time frame was before, but it happened before George Floyd's death. So, and I know other people, I know the person whose mom was held up by him and had trouble and filed a suit against the city. Yeah, so there's more to that story. So, you know, what does hatred lead you to do? Again, you know, God knows if it was murder or not. Certainly a jury of peers said it was murder. And yet, you think, was hatred in his heart? And, you know, on the flip side of that too, what saddens me, Nikos, is in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. You know, and it's, you think about peacemaking, waging for peace. You know, anybody can be and should be a peacemaker. But some people step into peacemaking in a different kind of way in their life. And Jesus says they'll be called children of God. Well, there's something really hard about waging for peace, and anybody who gives themselves to trying to make peace with people who are in conflict knows about this. And yet, that doesn't mean that people who are supposed to be an authority to serve and protect, which is an oft phrase of law enforcement agencies, serve and protect, that peacemakers end up becoming those that have unchecked anger. It leads to death, to murder, even. A sad thing, a terrible thing. And yet, on the flip side, if you have ever known a person in law enforcement, I happen to know one very well. My dad was in law enforcement for 30 years before he retired, because he got hit head on by a fugitive fleeing federal marshals. Crashed my dad head on. And my dad could be angry. He could be bitter and hurt because of that person's action. Or he could be hurt because when he was brand new on the force, he was in the jail and got beat up by a guy on PCP and has had neck problems since that event for the rest up into today. Still, he suffers pain because of that, but he's not hateful. He's not a hateful person. And yet some people in law enforcement harbor hate. And that hatred leads to a wrong use of their authority. It's sad. It's a really sad situation. So.
Yeah. Do you see any hope for America? Because you can just watch the news and you can just feel more and more depressed sometimes, even in the European Union. You know the American better than me, so
yeah. You know, it's interesting, because I think the story of humanity sort of has this overarching trend of improving as humans, but when it comes to hatred, it trails all the way back to Cain and Abel, the first recorded murder in the Hebrew Bible. And I don't think that we've really ever, as a society, gotten a grip on how to deal with hatred. And so I have hope for me in Christ. Being Christ-like, Christ was the only perfect person ever to live, according to most who study this sort of thing. This certainly from a monotheistic faith standpoint, in the holy books themselves, he's the only one that's reported to have been perfect, and to be a person who is compassionate like he was and is, it calls out to us. And so that's where my hope is. That's the focus and object of my hope in God. But yet, you know, you look on, try to take God out of it. Try just to be kind, to practice compassion. Try to be that kind of person. Well, man, that's just really hard, because to really love my neighbor like I'm going to love myself is just taxing. I would really rather just love myself and get around to loving my neighbor. And that just will never hunt for the fruition of peace in a sense of not killing one another. So, you know, I think we have an ebb and flow. I think when things are going good, people are receiving the mercy of God and acting upon it. And when things are not good, I think people are just paying attention to themselves. And that's a macro level. It's a big sort of flying high, 50,000 feet, and down on the floor, it's happening with how you treat your next door neighbor when they do something mean to you. What's your response when they do something mean? Is it just to return their meanness with meanness, or is it to extend kindness? And I think we just choose meanness. We choose to stay hurt, yeah, way too easily.
I think we're well trained to be mean to people because it's quite easy to be defensive on a lot of our interactions right now are done socially distant, and most of them are done online. So it's quite easy to develop a sort of combative attitude because there's not much consequences. So like if someone says something in LinkedIn that's a bit silly, it's quite easy to put something quite offensive back down, because then it's not like you're talking to somebody face to face. And so I think we're sort of trained psychologically and repetitively to be combative in real life, in a sense. But it remains to be seen how much that'll play out once we get back in the office, if it's just a internet thing that we behave like this versus real life interactions.
Wow, that's so true. That was a bulk of my conversation with this photographer. I said to him, you know, it's just really interesting, as much as we can advance in having real-time news be brought right to our cell phones, that we still don't know how to deal with the information that we are receiving. And, you know, I cited someone who's really close in my life and the burden that they were under during the waiting for the verdict. And as I was talking with them, I just noticed there was such a heaviness. And this person was really attuned to the news and to what people are saying. And I see that as, I think, an example of our society. And I think particularly our younger, I'm 41, so our younger society, people who have grown up with technology like we have today, the information is so readily available, except people don't know how to sort it out. They don't know how to make sense of it. And, you know, this photographer was showing me some pictures, and I have to say, man, I wish I could tell you, we could put it in the meeting notes to people to look up some of his pictures, because they were so amazing, some of them. But I'm looking at his pictures. He has this one picture of this. The photographer is standing behind this woman who is Black, and she's got her hands in the air. And then behind her in the scene are like a handful of SWAT geared up officers with firearms and other weapons running towards her. And you could see this look of despair on her face, and you can see this look of intensity and focus on the officers' faces. And to me, it's a lot like the picture of Chauvin with his knee on his neck, with the squad car. All you see is him with Floyd's neck and face down, and then you see the vehicle. And I think that picture is a picture that is an accurate picture. It that happened. It just like that. That vantage point was a real vantage point. What you don't see is two other officers holding him down for a chunk of time during that sequence. Now, it doesn't make it right what he did. I personally think, from what I've seen, that Chauvin was wrong for what he did and needs to be held accountable according to the law, as the jury found. So I'm on that side. That's just me sharing my viewpoint. But the picture tells something. If it was just one officer and he's so, you know, looking the way he did as he's looking up, it's a different kind of picture. Well, in this picture of this woman, she's, you know, she's in Brooklyn Center. This is sort of in the events of the unrest that happened in Brooklyn Center for Dante Wright's death. And I said to him, well, is it, because, you know, he's really supporting this narrative of, you know, violence with police and perpetrated against minorities, which is true. That definitely happens. But I said, was this during the curfew? And he goes, yeah. And I said, well, how do you feel about her being out against law during the curfew? Well, I feel mixed about it. Okay, well, what do you feel mixed about it? Well, you know, I feel like, you know, some people should be able to be out peaceably. I said, oh, well, they should be. Yeah, but, you know, you've got a black mayor who issues the curfew. And so you don't want people to have authority used negatively against them, particularly in a minority situation. So authority, maybe even a majority race, in authority over a minority person. You don't want that. You don't want a misuse of power there, but you do want to give permission for people to be breaking the law by being out after curfew. And literally, he can't even see his own double standard. And then the picture depicts authority being misused by them with their intention and focus on this woman, you know, her hands in the air, etc. It's like, It's an incomplete story. That's what I was trying to get by describing both of these pictures. I think they're incomplete and you have to look further. But if you just look at the picture and you just say to yourself, oh yeah, man, that's just, yeah, it's so wrong the way these police do this. And police make mistakes. There's no doubt about that. Law enforcement, they make mistakes. They're human as well. And
there's definitely a bias among people. They have an agenda to basically be against the government and the police and want society to change and to communism. A lot of people, like on the left, radical left. So
yeah,
there's a lot of things that are playing out. Could be a very dangerous place, America, in the next year or so.
Yeah, I do agree with that, man. And as much as for me, I'm not a pro-violence guy. So I mean, you know, just a war, I'm sorry. You just read Jesus a little bit more carefully. I don't think you're coming away with just war. If you are supposed to love your enemies and pray for them, I don't know how loving them leads to killing them. But nonetheless, there's a huge segment of Christ followers who think the just war theory is a legitimate theory. And I throw my hands in the air, because if you can't be honest about that, that's a problem. Well, here you have people having the right to bear arms in our Constitution. And, you know, it's not likely that Americans are going to lay down their firearms. So
you think firearms are a God-given right?
I don't. Actually, one of my meeting notes I wanted to speak on is the language of rights. So we should go there. But before we do, let me just finish this thought, if it's okay with you.
Sure.
It seems to me like people want to take away firearms because they see people being victims of firearms, and yet they're not thinking about what that means for folks who have a bad agenda. You know, like, you think that the bad guys, and when I say bad guys, I don't mean people who are intrinsically bad. I mean people who have bad behavior. You think folks who are up to no good, having bad behavior, are going to follow the law? They're going to find firearms. So it's like you have to at least listen to that. Now, for me, as a, I'm about as close to being a pacifist without being one as I can, I think, possibly be, as far as my heart can lead me to so far. And yet in that, you see Jesus having his, one of his closest companions having a sword in the garden before he's killed. And he says, you live by the sword, you die by the sword in the garden. So it's like, well, we do have to understand what it is to wage for peace, and using violence is a central aspect to waging for peace. And people don't seem to get on the right side of it. They think war, they think fighting, and they think violence is the answer. And I'm not seeing it effective in the long run. And so on rights, is it okay if I go to rights?
Sure, man.
Yeah, to me, Nikos, rights are at the center of this problem. And now what I'm about to say, I think, is pretty challenging. And I think people don't want to look on to this. When you are in a conversation about our topic today, if you focus on rights, I think you're already dead in the water, personally. The claim, at least in the worldview of those who follow Christ, is lay down your rights. Now, I want to say I'm a white male, middle America, and I know that. So it's easy to say lay down your rights if you're a part of the majority. It's kind of like pacifists who want to, you know, stoke anger in people who are, or confront people on violence, and then they are under the protection of those who fight and put themselves in harm's way. That's why I can't be a pacifist, even though I lean heavy here. It's like, it's easy to have a challenging word when you are covered by the majority because you are a part of a majority. But I still want to challenge this idea of rights, because I think the civil rights folks today, I have not heard anyone who is like 1,000 leagues from Martin Luther King. I mean, Martin Luther King understood the gospel. He understood the hope that the gospel brings. People don't want that. They would rather preserve their rights. And you see people fighting for their rights instead of laying down their rights. That's what non-retaliation is, I think, at the heart of it, what's it about in the Sermon on the Mount. You turn your cheek, you give the person the other cheek. Now, it's not saying you always do that. It's saying that you have a readiness to do that. And that readiness, I don't think people have that. They are really focused on their rights. What happens to this conversation around law enforcement and Black America if you take rights off the center stage and put it off to the side for a little bit? What happens?
You lose control.
You do. You lose control. You lose the ability to be so angry in a lot of ways, I think. But the conversation on rights is alive and well. And I don't think rights should be taken out entirely. Of course, rights are important and make up the fabric of justice. And yet, I don't think people want to look on to the real issue of surrendering of rights and living a life of compassion. This is where loving your neighbor comes in. If you're going to love your neighbor, man, that's going to change the world. People don't believe it.
Totally.
They just don't believe it. They'd rather believe something else. So rights is, and I could give you several verses, but I know this isn't
I think this pandemic, if we've basically lived among people that are hurting, and if even if ourselves have been hurting, which would help us to understand the pain, we can sort of have more compassion. And when we see people that are struggling and they're almost, their teeth are on edge with the anger of how they've been damaged by this whole pandemic, then we should help people, you know.
Yeah, that's so good, man. I mean, the best antidote to our misery is to look on to someone else and see that they have pain and challenges that are different from ours. And often there's something we can do about that pain. And that can be a means to reconciling oneself to themselves, for the pain that they have, at least move them forward. So compassion is the answer. And compassion out of obedience to God through Jesus is the Christian worldview. Unfortunately, people are not really that interested in it, it seems. And I say that, I feel like it's a little bit of a hard challenge, but I think it is. If we're going to try to deal with this mammoth thing of hatred, I mean, you put yourself, that most people put themselves surrounded by people who make the same income they do, who look like them, who have a background like them. That's natural. And it's not bad. It's not intrinsically bad to hang out with people who are like yourself. And I think sometimes people try to swing back the other way and say, oh, that, yeah, it's just so bad. No, but have an interest in people who are different from you, different economic status, different story of the way their life has unfolded, different culture, different faith, and watch what happens to your life. You realize, wait a second here, this is way more complicated than I was on to. And all of a sudden, I can't be so mad at how things are. And it's a struggle I'm saddened by is how are you going to help people deal with their hate? You need to learn where they can channel the surrender of their hatred and surrender their rights. Live a life of compassion because God is a God of compassion. So it's a hard word.
Can I just say a prayer and ask God to help us?
Yeah, definitely, man.
Dear Father in heaven, we just ask you would help me, Josh, and our listeners to be compassionate people and to teach others to be compassionate, Lord. We pray for this mercy in our own lives because we have to face up to our responsibility as humans representing you. Give us the power to live lives that glorify Jesus, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Amen. It's a privilege being on with you, man. Thanks so much. And certainly as we're going to hear the state seeking aggravated charges for Chauvin, we're going to see these other three officers who two of them were just days on duty, very brand new officers. On trial soon. So there's going to be more with that. Obviously, the appeal will take time as well, but see what happens with that. But man, let's be working on dealing with our hatred. Finding, identifying, do I have hatred? If I have hatred, I sure want to get rid of that, especially if it's going to lead to murder. Help each other move forward on that. I don't want to get rid of mine.
Good word, brother. It was good. Good to hear from you. And sharing your wisdom with us all.
And I look forward to getting on that trail with you outside your house, couple.
Yeah. Okay, buddy. All right, everybody, that was Joshua Weingart. And you've all heard him a few times before, living in Minneapolis. And we'll catch you all again soon on the Kaskasa Canis Show. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.